Hi, I'm Mark Lynch, Director of the Project on Middle East Political Science. Welcome to the Middle East Political Science Podcast. On this week's episode, we're speaking with Nathaniel Matthews of SUNY Binghamton, recently promoted to Associate Professor, and author of the brand new book, Zanzibar Was a Country, Exile and Citizenship Between East Africa and the Gulf, just published by University of California Press. Nathaniel, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Mark.
So it's really great to have a chance to finally read this book. We got to know each other working on this project on transregionalism and the connection between the Arabian Peninsula and East Africa, which is something which I've been encouraging people in my in Middle East studies circles to pay attention to a lot more than they used to. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to this book and this topic, and what you were trying to accomplish when you set out to study the connections between Zanzibar and the Arabian Peninsula.
Certainly. Thank you for that introduction. And, you know, the genius for this book goes back to my interest in Swahilophone cultures and in studying the Swahili coast, studying Swahili language, and realizing its reach extends not only beyond the coast to large parts of Eastern Africa, including the Eastern Congo, but also to Southern Arabia, to Oman. And so this is something that intrigued me, piqued my interest. I was able to go to Oman and sort of begin longstanding relationships with families and people in Muscat that were part of this Swahili-speaking community, and come to find out that many of them had actually been born in East Africa and continued to maintain family and cultural connections to the Swahili coast and to Eastern Africa. And so this... I started to conceive of a project that would engage my other interests of diaspora, and particularly the notion of African diaspora. I mean, because I think the question of the Swahili speakers in Arabia does raise an interesting question about what we mean by Africanity and what is an African diaspora, because these are literally migrants from Africa, recent migrants from Africa. And so all of these things make the story intrinsically interesting and intriguing. And the other piece of this is that the story that I tell has never been assembled in one place. It not only does it not really exist in any single archive, it's a story that nobody had really done a deep oral history with the community. And, you know, there had been some one-off articles, but not a lot that really truly connected events in East Africa to events in Southern Arabia. So that was what I wanted to do in the book.
And that's actually really interesting because, you know, I think a lot of people who work in Middle East studies, they might be vaguely familiar with this, but they might not really understand the true depth of the connections between the East African coast and the Arabian Peninsula. Could you tell us a little bit, just as a background, about kind of the story of Zanzibar and, you know, kind of the background for how we get to this level of interconnectedness?
Sure. Well, of course, the identity of the Swahili in East Africa is closely tied to this question of intermarriage with particularly with Arabs and Persians. Obviously the Swahili language also has a lot of borrowed vocabulary, particularly from Arabic. These connections are important. Oman late 18th century begins to exert more political power over East Africa, and eventually one Omani dynast, Sayyid Said from the Al Busaidi dynasty, sort of forms a state, the capital of which is actually in Zanzibar, that also includes much of Oman. And the Busaidis, even after the death of Sayyid Said and the division of his empire between the Omani and the Zanzibari wings. The Busaidis continued to rule in Zanzibar and to rule parts of the coast. And then when German colonial and British colonial rule is imposed over much of the coast, they enter into this, well, Zanzibar becomes a protectorate. They enter this relationship of protection. And so the dynasty is preserved throughout colonial rule. And then at the end of colonial rule, there is an attempt to use the dynasty as the basis to create an independent state in Zanzibar. And that's central to the story I tell, although it is a failed venture.
And we're talking about about 100 years or so of this kind of connection with the Saeeds actually moving the court to Zanzibar.
I guess we're somewhere around 100, 150 years. I would say that the political aspect of the relationship is about that long. The cultural aspect of the relationship is arguably much deeper. I mean, you have had Arabs not only from Oman but from Yemen, who have been migrating to the Swahili coast for a very long time. But you're right that this sort of political relationship dates from essentially from the 19th century and the empire of Sayyid Said.
Now, before we get to the Zanzibar Revolution and the creation of the diaspora, which is at the heart of the book, there's some really interesting dynamics here in terms of you're talking about intermarriage, but beyond that, there's a lot of racial and what we can call race making that goes on in this in terms of Arabs, in terms of Shirazis, in terms of who counts as part of which ethnic group and which class. Could you walk us through this a little bit? What kind of society, what kind of racial categorizations emerge in this context, and how does that shape what happens after?
Yeah, I mean, this is a contentious question for many in the community, the role of race and race making on the Swahili coast. I think it's fairly clear that as a result of Omani rule on the East African coast, Arab identity, well, certainly it makes a lot of Arabs very wealthy, one. And then there is a certain prestige attached to Arab identity, more so than in previous eras, the economic basis for the state, including the provisioning that happens, and also the country's main, the state's main export crop, cloves, are produced using enslaved African labor. This does create a very distinct class and racial dynamic as a result of, the majority of the slave masters, though not all, being Arab, and the majority of the slaves being from mainland African groups. When the colonial state comes along, as we know, one of the signature things about indirect rule was to sort of leave existing social relations alone, or to sort of be parasitic on them to achieve your own goals. And this is essentially what the British did in Zanzibar, was to let the dynasty remain in power. They did abolish slavery and outlaw it as a status. But land ownership patterns were not reformed. Cloves continued to be the basis for the export revenue for the state. And as a result of needing skilled pickers for cloves, former planters, former slave masters, gave former slaves a stake in the land. So some sort of kind of sharecropping type of relationship, in order to guarantee their labor, because the clove tree is a plant that requires a fair bit of specialized knowledge to know how to pick without destroying. And so that you have a situation where the land is still owned by the large, some of the largest former slave owners, but former slaves also have a significant stake in it. And debates over land and land ownership then prove very very divisive when Zanzibar is transitioning from becoming a protectorate to becoming an independent country based in the principle of democracy and popular sovereignty.
Okay, and let's pick it up there then. So you have kind of the waning of British colonialism. You've got all the struggles in Kenya and East Africa more broadly. And so Zanzibar then becomes independent, but it enters into the relationship. Well, you tell a story better than I can. Tell
Yeah.
us how do we get from kind of post-colonial independence to the revolution, which proved so disruptive to Zanzibar?
Yeah, so there are to simplify a complex story, but the British essentially decide that they want to transition Zanzibar to the parliamentary democracy model, and they begin to open up the Legislative Council, which had previously been made up of colonial appointees with a significant and notable lack of African representation. Other ethnicities were more well represented. Two main political parties form to contest these elections for the Legislative Council, and that is the Zanzibar Nationalist Party and the Afro-Shirazi Party. And to understand the tensions between them, I think first you have to understand that the Zanzibar Nationalist Party, or Hizb al-Watan, has its roots in the elites and middle classes, particularly Arabs who have been strongly influenced by traditions of Arab nationalism that are going on in places like Egypt. Of course, many of Zanzibar's Arabs had opportunity to study in Egypt and were influenced by the nationalist movement there, a kind of another story. And then the Afro-Shirazi Party. This is a An easily brokered truce between the African Association and the Shirazi Association. And to distinguish the difference between them, the African Association, largely made up of mainland migrants to Zanzibar during the colonial era, some formerly enslaved people as well, and the Shirazi Association, made up of peoples who are claiming indigeneity in Zanzibar as a result of, they were the people there before the Omanis arrived and established their state. And actually, they had a ruler, the Mwinyimku, who was kind of incorporated into the Omani state structure when the Omanis took over. And they actually, even before the Mwinyimku, they were ruled by some by various kings and queens on both Pemba and Unguja, the two islands that make up the sort of Zanzibar Atoll, if you will, or the Zanzibar Isles. So the African Association and the Shirazi Association kind of have this shared, the members have this shared idea that there's a disproportionate amount of political power in Arab hands. But the party actually undergoes a number of splits based on the race question. One of the big breakdowns is the idea that Arabs are essentially not really or cannot be Africans, and this is a hard a pill to swallow for many Shirazis, even if they do have particular grievances with the Arabs, because culturally and familially they are much closer to the Arabs as a result of intermarriage. The relationship between Arabs and Shirazis in Unguja, which is where the capital is much more contentious and racialized than the relationship between Arabs and Shirazis in Pemba, where land ownership patterns are more equal. Arabs and Shirazis live more side by side, and there isn't the same level of massive land accumulation as you see in Unguja. But those are the two political parties.
And so,
They
and the
contest a
Shirazis
number of.
here, this is not, for those of us who study like transnational Shia networks, these are not the Shirazi'in from Iran.
Thank you for that. That could be a bit confusing
Yeah,
for some of
exactly. For a
your
Middle East studies
listeners.
crowd.
Yeah, these are not people coming from Shiraz in Persia. These are groups that claim Persian ancestry, but culturally speaking, have much more in common and are much closer to other Muslim Swahili speaking peoples of the coast, of which there are many different ones. But actually, the DNA evidence is in. We have some genetic sequencing that's been done to show that this connection to Persia, which has always been part of the oral history of many Shirazi groups, actually was demonstrated within the larger population genetically. So there was some sort of connection. But anyway, that is important to Shirazi self-conceptions, and of course, all these ethnicities are permeable, including Arab ethnicity, permeable in various ways and capable of being, spun off into projects of imagined community that can be more or less inclusive.
And that's going to become really important to the next part of the conversation when you start looking at the attempts of Zanzibaris to find a place in the Gulf and what communities they're imagined to be part of.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think what influences that drive, that search for community, just to maybe finish answering your previous question, is the Zanzibar Revolution, which after 3 to 4, what is it, 3 to 4 failed elections, inconclusive elections, where the Afro Shirazi Party wins a majority of the vote, but because this is a parliamentary democracy, was not able to form a government based on the number of seats in the legislature. Eventually, the last election that occurs in 1963, the ZNP and a new party, an offshoot of this Shirazi party, which I noted had this tension between African and Shirazi elements, they actually are able to form a government in spite of not winning a majority of the popular vote. And they do so, and the British hand over power to them at the end of 1963. And a month later, the revolution occurs, unseats that government, and installs the Afro Shirazi party into power with the ASP head, Abed Karume, as Zanzibar's first revolutionary Zanzibar's first president. And this results in a pogrom, which occurs during the revolution, kills a few thousand people, and then a sort of a process of exile in the year after the revolution, where also maybe 5 to 10,000 people leave, maybe more, through the auspices either of the UNHCR and the Red Cross, or making an informal voyage out of Zanzibar, either to the mainland or sometimes to southern Arabia.
And that's interesting. I mean, you go into the book in quite some detail about the arguments about whether this constitutes a genocide, as some Zanzibari intellectuals claim. But also the part that's interesting here is that so the violence is directed against those with an Arab identity at the Arabs for various reasons. But then they close the borders. They don't want people leaving. And so you have the situation where you mentioned UNHCR, but there's some really graphic descriptions in here of the dhow voyages and the difficulty of getting transit to the Arabian Peninsula. Maybe talk about that a little bit, but also in the context of the historiography that you pieced together to the oral histories that you used just to reconstruct what happened in those difficult days.
This is one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, is also to offer an account of the aftermath of the Zanzibar Revolution, that takes account of the emotional weight of that event in people's memories that I grounded with and talked with. I do think that it is important to talk about this both because it is a, you know, the revolution is a legacy for all Zanzibaris, and they continue to wrestle with it, but also because the Zanzibar revolution had an impact, its impact resonated beyond just East Africa, but it actually had an impact on the development of modern Oman. And yeah, in terms of the refugee crisis, and the violence that occurs, well, it convinces some people that they need to leave Zanzibar by any means necessary, almost immediately. And initially, the revolutionary government sort of sees this as desirable. We're getting rid of people that were never going to be our supporters anyway. It is important, I think, to note for your readers that although Arabs are targeted in the pogrom, the targeting is ultimately really about members of the Zanzibar Nationalist Party. This is kind of, I think, where race and race thinking, though, plays a role, because it is sort of assumed that if you are Arab in Zanzibar at this time, you must be supporting the Zanzibar Nationalist Party, because there is this propaganda that it is essentially an Arab party, and Arabs are a substantial part of its support and its membership, no doubt. But the people targeted in the revolution were not just Arabs. Any supporters of the Zanzibar Nationalist Party could potentially be targeted by the mob, because the mob was initially sent out. It became more than this, but it was initially sent out by militants because they heard rumors that there was armed opposition in various parts of the island. And so it was sent to initially sent with weapons to kind of quash that. So escapes out of Zanzibar. Your question was about when does the Zanzibar government kind of cut things off? I mean, there is a certain point where people are leaving, but it's like, okay, fine, leave. But then you start seeing, and the initial group of people that are leave that leave are called in the documents by the UNHCR Manga Arabs, which is a term that in Zanzibar signifies somebody who is an immigrant, particularly from Oman, particularly from like the Omani interior, and therefore, you know, distinguished from this earlier 19th century group of Arabs who became quite wealthy. The Manga are poor and middle class, and so they are the first ones to leave. They're the most affected by the violence, especially by the, you know, kind of indiscriminate racialized character of some of it. And but at some point, the more wealthier and educated Arabs also begin to leave, decide that they're, which is a much more difficult decision because they have deeper family networks in Zanzibar. They have a lot of family at the coast. And so once they start leaving is when the revolutionary government really starts to say, okay, we need to halt the brain drain that's happening here. And so we're going to either make you know, pay all the school fees for your children before you can leave, but we're going to extract a price, and we're going to make it very difficult for you to leave so
And the
that you
key
would
thing is they
confiscate
take
your
the passports.
passports.
They take the
Yeah,
passport.
yeah.
That's the key, right?
Yes, yeah, you have to go to the central office. You know, even allies of the regime would have to go through this very onerous process of requesting permission to use your own passport to leave the country. And so that happens in the I think it's 1967. So it takes a few years, right? Because a lot of people after the revolution are saying, well, you know, okay, that was bad, you know, but I'll ride this out. This is my home, you know, and we'll see what happens. So that's why you have all these dhow voyages, and some people I talked to in Oman talking about leaving on a fishing boat or paying somebody off to take them to the mainland, where that they would try to get to Mombasa, where there was a UNHCR office. They could claim asylum, and they could try to get like a passport or a travel document to go to Dubai. Dubai being the most welcoming of Zanzibaris, the most
Yeah.
welcoming emirate for Zanzibaris in this period.
And that I think is a good transition point. We're going to take a short break. We're sitting with Nathaniel Matthews about his book Zanzibar Was Country, and we'll be back in a moment. This is the Middle East Political Science Podcast. I'm Mark Lynch, and we're back with Nathaniel Matthews talking about his book Zanzibar Was a Country. So before the break, we were talking about the deeper history of Zanzibar and the revolution. And when we left off, we had refugees from Zanzibar who were heading towards the Arabian Peninsula, whether through UNHCR or on these dhow boats, whatever. And you mentioned that Dubai was the most welcoming of the places in the Gulf. Tell us why, and also why not Oman, since that was the most obvious connection.
Yeah, thank you for that. Oman did actually accept a few thousand refugees from Zanzibar after the revolution, but then the Sultan Said bin Taymor kind of didn't want to continue to receive migrants from Zanzibar for a couple of reasons. One, he's dealing with an insurgency, a rebellion in the interior of the country to establish a sovereign state for a political form with a long history in Oman called the Imamate. Okay, so the Sultan is head of the Sultanate, which has its capital in Muscat. But the Imamate in the interior, the mountainous interior of the country, the Imamate forces want to establish their own state, and relations between the interior and the coast break down. The significance of that for Zanzibar is that many of the same interior tribes that were supporting the Imamate have family connections in East Africa. And so at one point, I think Imamate supporters are trying to go to East Africa to raise money and then come back to Oman. One of them gets like stopped by customs and discovered with all of this stuff that he's going to use to support the Imamate. So there's that factor. And then in general, I think Said bin Taymor was associated Zanzibaris, perhaps because of the revolution, because of the rumors that it was a communist revolution, it was poorly understood what was actually going on. Associates Zanzibaris with some sort of like political subversion that he doesn't want in his country. And so he's so most Zanzibaris, even those who have Omani roots, are not able to go to Oman at this point, are not able to find a home in Oman. And some of them try and are turned away at the border. Many go to Dubai. At this point, Dubai is trying to do the this is actually a period before the Emirates has officially formed, right? So we're talking about the late 60s, and Dubai is trying to chart a path towards development in somewhat of a different path to its neighbor Abu Dhabi. Abu Dhabi has a lot more petroleum wealth. Dubai doesn't have as much. So Dubai really tries to set its economy around being kind of like a free trade zone. And Sheikh Rashid sees that Zanzibaris are leaving Zanzibar and basically encourages them and allows them to come to Dubai with minimal interference. There are housing developments built for them in Rashidiyya, and they're able to sort of get permanent residence essentially in Dubai, or a local form of nationality, which is not the same as a later of federal Emirati nationality,
And
which
one thing
becomes an
which is
issue
interesting
later.
here is that the Zanzibaris tend to be pretty well educated and they tend to have pretty good English, but not much
That's
Arabic.
right. That's right. That's right. These are relatively privileged migrants. Their education level is generally higher than the average Emirati or Omani at this time, quite a bit higher. And so they have, and they also have English language skills, but not Arabic language skills. So that's an interesting thing. It makes them attractive to places like banks. Like many of them end up working at banks. But at the same time, those who want to get a job driving a taxi, it's a little bit more difficult, because you really kind of have to know more Arabic. This is a challenge for also the offspring of those who leave, who are just entering primary or secondary education, because you really can't find the same level of education as these people, as their parents had in Zanzibar, in the Gulf at the time. So this is the community in Dubai, that several thousand people probably by the late 1960s. Some of them are not staying in Dubai. They go elsewhere to find employment. Some of them go to Qatar, which is a little bit relatively more affluent. Kuwait, Abu Dhabi. Some of them. A few of them go to Dammam, where the exiled Imam of Oman is living in the 60s. And then this becomes another issue with Said bin Taymour, because there's all these rumors that the Imam is sort of training an army to come back and conquer the country, and that the Zanzibaris are being used in that army, being trained in Saudi Arabia for this. And Said bin Taymour was also just a generally paranoid person, I think.
But one thing I think we want to emphasize here, given its centrality to the book, is that there's a big difference between residency and citizenship, and where they're allowed to actually gain nationality and the types of nationality they're allowed to get. Like you pointed out that Abu Dhabi, citizenship is really valuable with all that oil wealth, and so that's one of the reasons they're less welcoming. But talk a little bit about kind of citizenship, passports, and kind of how this plays out for Zanzibaris, because most of them have left without actual passports.
Yeah, some people had their passports burned up in the revolution. Some of them, had their passports confiscated by Karume and had to make an illegal departure. A few do have imamate passports, right? So the imamate re rebellion insurgency does fail. But Imamate continues to maintain passport offices outside the country, and issue passports. And so they do issue these Omani Imamate passports to some Zanzibari refugees. And the function of this passport is interesting, because it doesn't allow you to enter Oman, but it does allow you to have some mobility in the Gulf, and to actually leave East Africa. So some of them can get, like some sort of local residence permit using this imamate passport, even though they can't use it to assert a claim on nationality. Now, later on, when when Qaboos comes into power in Oman, they are able to use the Omani imamate passport and exchange it for an Omani sultanate passport. So some of these are genuinely stateless people. Some of them do have these passports that are whose utility is limited. Some of them are traveling on how you call it, laissez, what is it called, laissez passer or something like this. So essentially, like allowing you to travel, allowing you to transit, and not much else. And they are able to get local residency in the in Dubai and Qatar and these other places, but. There's really no path to nationality. Some few Zanzibaris do get Dubai nationality, but again, getting Dubai nationality is not the same. And Nora Lorry has, sort of written a whole book on this, the difference between the nationality issued by the individual emirates and the federal nationality status, which is much harder to obtain, and is much more based in you having some sort of lineal ancestral connection to the tribes that have historically inhabited the area under the control of the Emirates. And so the Omanis are those of Omani descent, or Zanzibaris of Omani descent, or Zanzibar refugees, or Manga refugees, whatever you want to call them, in the Gulf at this time, even though they do have some sort of lineal ancestral connection to Omani tribes, are not able to enter Oman. So they are sort of stranded in the, and not able to achieve a full nationality in the Emirates. So they're kind of stuck between these two statuses.
So eventually this begins to change then, and you start to see the kind of the more of an integration of the Zanzibaris into Oman. Talk a little bit about that and kind of how that change happens and what the significance of it is for the people involved.
I think it's really important to in transitioning to talk about this, to talk about the distinction that I make in the book between political exiles and diaspora communities, which is a distinction that I find very useful in the work of Nira Yuval Davis. Political exiles being those who maintain an orientation toward the Zanzibar homeland outside of Zanzibar, and to the politics of the Union, to democracy in Zanzibar, and continue to think of Zanzibar as their nation. And the diaspora communities who kind of see the project of mostly a younger generation, who tend to see the project of their elders getting involved in politics as a failed project, quixotic venture that ended in tragedy, and either are trying to pursue more material things that would allow them to have a stable life, which include a secure nationality, education, etc., and eschewing politics, and also undergoing an inward turn where towards piety, where piety becomes a retreat from the gross and base nature of the secular contestation for power. And so these two dynamics come together, and then there is in 1970 a palace coup in Oman. Okay, and so people who have been striving for a nationality, striving to educate themselves in diaspora, now under the new regime of Sultan Qaboos in Oman, the Omani diaspora, which is not just in East Africa but was actually all over the Gulf, is invited back to develop the country. And returnees as part of this, returnees from East Africa as part of this Omani diaspora, are an extremely important aspect of Oman's development in this period. For the simple fact of Oman had is a late modernizer, has no modern educational institutions, had not been training a sort of national bourgeoisie to take over from the British protectorate officials, and so who steps into that role are the returnees from East Africa, who had had a fairly high level of education. Been trained in, before the revolution to take over the Zanzibar civil service, that is to manage all the different ministries and government. So it's as if these people who were trained for this role in another context now are coming to Oman, making a claim on a lineal connection, some of, in some cases, which has attenuated, which is, not a living lineal connection, but an imagined one. It's like, oh, this is my long lost Lemke relative from, my great great grandfather's a cousin or uncle or something like this, right? But they become extremely important to Oman's late development trajectory, and they help essentially indigenize the civil service and other, key professional positions that make the Omani state a modern one.
And they become quite sultanist.
And they do become quite sultanist. So this is another interesting, I think, continued trajectory of the diaspora community trajectory talked about earlier, which is to say that you're going from a country where at least some of you were involved in supporting a constitutional monarchy and a parliamentary democracy, to a country under absolutist rule, which that absolutist rule, as one Tariq Abdul Razak has written in Monster and Revolution, was in part an invention of the British. The power, the absolute power of the Sultan in the Sultanate was not as powerful as the British made it under British protection, say that. This is a period when monarchy is being challenged across the Afro-Asian world. As a result of British protection, and as a result of oil revenues used to modernize the state, Oman is essentially able to get out ahead of or avoid the anti-monarchical trend, which is of a pace with the general turn towards popular sovereignty in the broader Indian Ocean, Africa, and the Middle East. And entrench, an absolutist form of rule, when it's on the way out in other parts of the Middle East.
So this is all really fascinating, but as we come to the end of our conversation, I wanted to take this in a slightly different direction, because when you're reading the book, there's a lot more to it than just like this diplomatic and institutional type of history. It seems like you went to a lot of depth in terms of getting oral histories, different kinds of publications, and kind of unofficial types of archives. Can you tell us a little bit about the historiographical process of this and kind of how that part of the book came to be?
Sure. Thank you for that question, Mark. One, I think that it is extremely important for historians doing modern history to do oral history. I think historians are often pinged for living by the Rankean dictum: what does not exist in the archive has not lived. In African history, that is really not the case. Oral history is strongly encouraged, and is often, as in my case, one of the only ways to get certain kinds of knowledge, because it has not been written down. It is primarily privileged in an oral setting. And that's the case with Memories of the Zanzibar Revolution, most definitely. So first and foremost, is out of a necessity to get the story right, because the archival fragments that do exist, and some of the memoirs, it's just not enough. You really have to put it together with some serious grounding in oral history. And I was privileged to kind of be in the right place at the right time, at a certain time in Muscat and Oman, when some of these people were still alive, and were willing to talk to me. Many people were actually still reluctant to talk to me about the revolution, even when I was doing my work. So the first thing is out of necessity, wanting to get the whole story, which I think is extremely important if you're doing a modern history project, as I am. You can't not talk to people who lived through the events, even if their testimony is biased. But the second thing is, I think, a question of narrative. I wanted to give that personal dimension to the narrative, because these are people's memories, because they are so central to the story. I did, and I think it makes it easier for the reader to digest the more complex structural transformations when you can see that structural transformation, or some of the dilemmas that it creates, acted out in the course of a single life. So this is why I think, I included a lot of that, and I wanted to include a lot of it. Because it makes what might be a kind of a drier narrative, I think it's still interesting, of development and economic transformation. It makes it a genuinely human story. I think that makes it more interesting to read. I think it makes it easier to read. And I just fundamentally, Mark, I can't imagine this story without the oral histories there at the center.
As a reader, I very much agree. I mean, it really brings a lot of this to life. And you get, like, for example, the disconnect between kind of a dry UNHCR document about 15 migrants left today versus being able to tell that story of the people getting on the dhow and it's springing a leak and them not having any food or water. Like, those it really supplements each other quite nicely, I thought.
Yeah, and this is something that more work, is coming up, and more work should be done. Judith Marshall is writing on a similar kind of topic, doing grounding in oral histories in Zanzibar in a way that I really didn't. My hope is that Omanis will also, particularly descendants of returnees from East Africa, kind of pick up this story and inquire deeply, more deeply into their parents' particular histories and trajectories and relationship to East Africa, because honestly, it's really the tip of the iceberg. There are a lot more untold stories than there are told stories in this archive of oral histories and personal recollections.
That's a really interesting idea, and I hope you pursue that. Let me ask one last question, which is that this project fits nicely within this broader trend towards Indian Ocean studies and towards kind of trying to look at these transregional connections in this part of the world. And that's what attracted me to the work originally. And I wonder if you had any thoughts you wanted to share here at the end about kind of the value of these kinds of transregional or Indian Ocean approaches to doing this kind of historical research. Like, what are we missing as Middle East studies people if we don't take that approach, and vice versa from the African perspective?
I guess there's many potential payoffs of this sort of approach. Obviously, displacing or problematizing methodological nationalism, which tends to narrow our focus as scholars, taking a wider lens. I think it's extremely important for the dimensions and the contours of citizenship in nation states in general in the Indian Ocean to take in this transregional perspective, to expand the capaciousness of the visions of imaginative, because the nation is not going anywhere, right? But if nations were able to understand that their own histories are much larger and more complicated than some of these very narrow visions of imagined community, I think there could be some embrace of pluralism in the making of national citizenship. So it could have some practical effects taking this transregional lens. And then in general, I do think that diasporas, Indian Ocean diasporas, remain extremely important to Indian Ocean history. There has been a narrative of the old Indian Ocean world was kind of was destroyed and lost with colonialism and then with modernity and the rise of the nation state. And so what I wanted to show is that although these connections were stymied or damaged or temporarily severed in some cases, that there is a persistence of these diasporic links across the Indian Ocean between different littoral societies, even in the presence of the nation state. And if anything, I think that this that these connections since the 1990s have been again growing and becoming quite important and quite prominent. There's a whole literature, obviously, on remittances, the role of diasporic remittances in national economies, given the wealth of the Gulf, given the number of East Africans and others who migrate there to work and send money back home. I think it's extremely important to take a transregional focus, transregional lens onto the Gulf, lest we miss some of these important global and transregional connections.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting, and it definitely is a trend that that should be encouraged. I lied. That wasn't the last question. But one last question, which probably should have been the first question. The title, Zanzibar Was a Country. Why?
Yes. This is a nod to Chinua Achebe's memoir, There Was a Country, which is about Biafra and the situation of Biafra and Zanzibar parallel in some interesting ways. Fun fact, Tanzanian President Julius Nyerere was one of the few African leaders to actually support Biafran claims to national self-determination. At the same time that Tanzania was formed out of a union between mainland called Tanganyika and Zanzibar. And so at a time when some people in Zanzibar were calling for a similar type of national self-determination for Zanzibar, Nyerere was supporting Biafran self-determination, but opposing Zanzibar, separating from the Union and exercising its own national self-determination. It continues to be very important to people in Zanzibar. Obviously, there's no movement to make Zanzibar a country in Oman or in diaspora really anymore. But the ideas that the exiles and others continue to preserve of Zanzibar as a sovereign country does influence, continue to influence the attitudes of the political opposition today in Zanzibar and the status of future status of the union with Tanganyika to create Tanzania.
It was a really eye-opening book, and thank you for writing it. We've been speaking with Nathaniel Matthews about his book, Zanzibar Was a Country, Exile and Citizenship Between East Africa and the Gulf, just out with the University of California Press. And thanks for listening to the podcast.